In a culture obsessed with accumulation, achievement, and consumer comfort, it's easy to get swept into the endless drive for more. But what if that pursuit is actually keeping us from the life God wants for us? This five-week series at Sycamore Creek Church explores how Jesus invites us to be free from the love of money and free for a life of purpose, generosity, and joy. You'll uncover spiritual practices and countercultural truths that help you step off the treadmill and into a posture of gratitude and stewardship. Whether you're living paycheck to paycheck or sitting on a surplus, God's desire is the same: freedom.
Life moves fast without any obvious like exits or off ramps. I mean, you're just flying down the road. I have a lead foot. I'm working on it. I've been working on it for years, but you know, this happens all the time in cars. Have you ever been driving to Detroit and you end up like accidentally getting on the bridge to Canada? I've only had this happen once. And once you get on, like there's no turning around. Like there's no off ramp. Of course, there's the really classic scene from European Vacation. As a dad, I of course have to say this every single time my kids go around and around and around something.
I guess what we do is just drive around this circle here. It should be the second left exit. There's the hotel. Hey, look, kids! There's Big Ben and there's Parliament!
There it is!
I know. I can't seem to get over to the left, honey. I'll try next time. Sorry. We'll get out of this jam in a minute. Kids! Big Ben! Parliament! Again.
We know, Big Ben.
Parliament. Look, kids, forget it. It's amazing. I cannot get left. There's Big Ben, kids. Parliament.
Wood Street. Sam's Way. Wood Street. Sam's Way. At about this point, everybody's like, what is the guy in BMW doing? Look, kids. Sam's Way. Look, kids. Wood Street. Look, kids, that's an idiot driving around the circle over and over and over again. Look, kids, fantastic finds. Life moves fast and there is no obvious like off-ramp or exit. Then there's those moments where you get in like password limbo, like where the like two-step verification or three-step verification or whatever. This is one of my favorite videos of all time on Instagram Reels. And I literally just had this happen like a couple weeks ago.
No, that is my password.
That password is incorrect.
What? No, this is my password.
That password is incorrect. I won't be letting an intruder in on this account.
Oh my God, it's me. It's not that serious.
Security is not a joke.
Fine, reset my password.
We've sent you a link to reset your password. You have 9 seconds to log into your email, click on the link, and set a new password.
What?
And your time started 5 seconds ago.
Why is it timed?
Fine, here's a new password. Your new password cannot be the same as your current password.
You mean the password you just told me is not my password?
You are exhibiting extremely suspicious activity.
What?
Yeah, go ahead and send over the test.
This is my account.
What word is this?
What? That's not even a word.
Wrong. Select all squares that include a bike.
There's not even a bike in there.
You have failed the robot test. We have confirmed that you are in fact a robot and a threat to your account. You will be locked out for the next 67 days.
What? You're the only robot here. What? This is my account.
Our tests have concluded you are in fact a robot and will be locked out of your own account for the next 67 days. You are exhibiting extremely suspicious activity.
What?
Yeah, we're gonna need that test.
When my parents died, they owned a timeshare in the Bahamas. And timeshares are notorious for like being, like you can't get out of them. And the estate, my dad's estate may still own the part of that timeshare. I just gave up, like I was done, whatever. Life moves fast and there is just no exit or off ramp. Like getting stuck on a bridge going to Canada, or like getting stuck in a roundabout, going round and round and round and getting car sick and more car sick, or getting in a Bermuda Triangle a password security, or in a timeshare albatross. We get stuck in the rat race of materialism and consumerism in our culture, and there is no off-ramp. There is no stop sign where you can stop. All right, so here's a chat question. Turn to the passenger in your car or wherever you're at and talk about this question. When have you experienced getting caught up in something and being unable to let go of it? Let's talk about it. So just like nobody starts life wanting to be an addict or wanting to get divorced or have their life fall apart, nobody starts out life wanting to be materialistic, wanting to be consumeristic. We just get swept up in it. We get pulled along with the wind or the cultural trends. Zach Lambert is the pastor of the Church Restore Austin in Austin, Texas. And we've been using his sermon series, Free Money, as the wrap up to our big, huge, long experiment of spending 18 months in Jesus' most famous teaching, the Sermon on the Mount. In Zach's sermon, he shares a quote from the book Free. If we don't make conscious choices to resist these impulses, the force of a materialistic and consumeristic society will make most of our decisions for us. Our lives just get swept up in consumption and consumerism. It's kind of like being on a people mover. In fact, we've used that illustration before when it comes to anti-racism. In anti-racism circles, we talk about how the culture moves in a sort of certain racist way. And if you are not doing anything, you just go along with it. So you have to walk against faster than the people mover. Well, the same thing is true of consumerism and materialism. Like the culture is like a people mover that is moving in a materialistic and consumptious way. Is consumptuous a word? Well, I don't know, but I'm going to use it today. A consumptuous way, and you have to walk faster than, you have to swim upstream to not get swept away by it. What we're trying to do in this series is to reframe money. It's not a budgeting problem. Money is a spiritual problem. Free money is not just about budgeting, it's about freedom. The off-ramp isn't about budgeting, it's about freedom. And last week we looked at the first principle in this reframing. Principle number one, it's not just money. Money has a sort of force to it. It has a sort of spiritual power. In fact, Jesus refers to it with the name of a god. Jesus calls it mammon. And a lot of times we think of money as neutral, like you can do good with it, you can do bad with it. But there are theologians who see it not as neutral, but rather it has this sort of negative force that pulls us along with it. Paul talks about it in this way. The love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Now, this quote from Paul gets misquoted all the time. A lot of times you hear people say the love of money is the root of all evil. That's not what Paul was saying. I don't even think that's true. But the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Life moves fast. This consumerism, this materialism moves fast. And there's no obvious off-ramp or exit. Like we get swept up in it. And it burrows deep into our lives. And all kinds of evil comes out of those roots. All right, so that's principle number one. It's not just money. But today we're gonna add a second principle to it. Principle number two, we don't own anything. In fact, ownership is an illusion. It's a practical illusion and it's a legal illusion. By practical, what I mean is we're standing here in Mount Hope Cemetery. I mean, This is a beautiful cemetery, but spoiler alert, we're all gonna end up, maybe not in as beautiful of a cemetery as this, but we're all gonna end up 6 feet in the ground, or our ashes scattered over some beautiful spot that we love. And all of the things that we have accumulated in this life, it doesn't go with us. It ends up like, it ends up just as a headstone. So ownership is a practical illusion. We don't take anything with us when we die, but it's also a legal illusion. Like it's only by this agreed consensus of laws that ownership means anything. In fact, we can change the law and your ownership disappears. Or we can write a law that says, we're gonna take some of your money from you to pay for everything. It's taxes, it's not really your money. Like we can write a law and take it from you. Or think about the laws of eminent domain. You can own like your property, but then the community, the political community can say, no, you don't own it because we need to put a highway through there. In fact, if you are on the underside of power, your sense that ownership is an illusion is even stronger because you don't feel protected by those laws. Ownership is an illusion. Ownership is not just a practical illusion or a legal illusion, it's also a theological illusion. Let's take a look at several different scriptures to see how different writers in the Bible think about ownership. St. Paul says, "We brought nothing into the world and we can take nothing out." Job says, "I came naked from my mother's womb and I will be naked when I leave." The teacher of Ecclesiastes says, "We can't take our riches with us." And Jesus, in one of his classic parables, these little stories that tell us something about what is really real, Jesus tells the story of a rich fool. This is a farmer and he has like a bumper crop and there's so much that he's like, oh my gosh, I can just store all of this. I can build bigger barns and I can sit back and relax and I'm set for like the rest of my life. And so he does it. He like hires people to build bigger barns and he stores all of this stuff. And Jesus says, listen, this guy is a fool because the next day he dies. John Wesley was the founder of the Methodist Renewal Movement in the Church of England in the 18th century. He's kind of a contemporary of George Washington. And he started this spiritual renewal movement that just took on like wildfire. And he had a lot to say about money. Here's one from one of his sermons. "When the possessor of heaven and earth brought you into being and placed you in this world, God placed you here not as a proprietor, but as a steward." All right, let me unpack that just a little bit. Like Wesley's basically just saying, like, when God put you here, God didn't put you here as an owner, not a proprietor, but rather as like a steward. And we're going to start to unpack that word steward here in just a moment. But the main thing I'm trying to get across to you as I'm standing here again in Mount Hope Cemetery is that ownership is an illusion. All right, so turn to the gravestone next to you or the person sitting next to you who will one day be a gravestone and talk about this question. How hard is it for you to believe that you really don't own anything? So the first principle that we were looking at last week was that it's not just money. And the second principle that we were looking at today is that you don't own anything. But there's a second part to this second principle, and that is that God owns everything. Let's again turn to the Bible and see how some of the authors of the Bible talk about this principle. In the book of Exodus, God says, "All the earth is mine." In the book of Job, God says, "Everything under heaven belongs to me." In the Psalms, the psalmist says, "The cattle on a thousand hills are mine." I don't know about you, but I'd like to go over to that house for a good steak dinner. So there's a couple theological truths. We are stewards, not owners. What we have is on loan. Ben Witherington III, a contemporary New Testament scholar, says, "The question is, are we in tune with God's preferences about such matters?" When I think about this idea, I immediately go back to some different kind of moments of conflict I had, particularly with my dad. When my dad was
getting close to the end of his life, and my stepmom was also close to the end of her life. They both died in 2018. My stepmom had ovarian cancer. By the point she was diagnosed, she died about 9 months later. And my dad had been battling Lewy body dementia for about 6 years. But while they were still both living in their house and still living together, both still alive, my dad asked me to take a picture of them so that he could, well, he wanted me to put some text on it, and then he wanted to share it in a particular way. So I took this picture of them. It's kind of an iconic image of my parents at the end of their lives. Both of them have basically like no hair. My stepmom from chemo, my dad just from getting old and wearing his hair really short. But I took that picture, and for me, I looked at his blue t-shirt that said Colts on it. And to me, that was a distraction. Like, the point wasn't about like sports. So I used some of my Photoshop skills, and I made Colts disappear so that it was just a blue shirt. And this is what I came up with. When my dad saw this, what I had done, he was pretty upset. Like, he's like, well, what happened to the Colts? And I said, I took it out. It's like, look at what I did with this. This is pretty cool. But to me, it was a better picture. To him, it lost something. It lost like something of who he was. And later on, I thought, after I had that whole situation, I thought, well, who was I to take that out? Like, if he's the one, it's his picture. He made the choices. Like, just because I have the skills to do it doesn't mean I should have done it. And again, I'm a steward of the image. I'm not the owner of it. He was. Now, fast forward a couple of months from the point this picture was taken, and my stepmom had died, and I had become the power of attorney for my dad. So I am literally making all of his financial decisions for him, all of them, with the money that my stepmom had left for him. And I had to, on a regular basis, ask myself this question: am I spending this money for him in a way that honors him and who he has been through his whole life? Which was very complicated because his dementia, he was a very different person at that point. And sometimes he'd want to spend money in ways that I don't think an earlier version of himself would have done. But in each one of those cases, I'm having to ask the question, like, it's not my money. I'm not spending it the way that I want. I'm spending it in a way that, well, I'm being a steward of his money for him. All right. I'm trying to unpack this concept of what it means to be a steward in this principle that ownership is an illusion and you don't own anything. God owns everything. So turn to a neighbor and talk about this question. What are some modern day examples of stewardship that you've seen? Let's talk about it. So we've been talking about the second principle of reframing money, and that is that you don't own anything. God owns everything. How do we put this into practice, like on a really practical level? Well, there's one really concrete practice, that is gratitude. Let's look at two ways to practice gratitude. The first is to pray a prayer of gratitude at every purchase. What would it look like to pray a prayer of gratitude every time you bought something? I think what this would do is it would reframe spending as stewardship. If we go back to John Wesley, he offered a couple of questions to ask every single time that you make a purchase. Now, this is like a serious challenge, okay? Like, when I read this, Wesley is punching me in the gut. And sometimes preachers have to punch you in the gut. I'm not talking about literal, I'm talking about metaphorical, okay? So he punches me in the gut, at least, And here's his set of questions. Am I acting as the owner or a steward of God's goods? Does Scripture support this expense? Can I offer this purchase as a sacrifice to God? And will I be rewarded for this spending at the resurrection? Oh my gosh. Like, who would ever buy anything? I mean, in some sense, like, that's Wesley's point. Like, we could live a lot more simply than we did if we reframed our money, not as ownership, but as being a steward. Now, recently, on my 50th birthday, my wife took me on a trip to downtown Detroit. It was just a beautiful getaway with the two of us, doing some of my favorite things, big cities, eating at fun places. And then we just window shopped through the kind of shopping district, and I came across the Shinola store. And I've never actually been in a Shinola store. I've seen them advertised. And I walk in, and I don't know how much you know about Shinola. I have a family member through Sarah's family that used to work at Shinola. And Shinola brought a lot of European craftsmanship to watchmaking to the United States, to Detroit, as a kind of way of rebuilding this craftsmanship of watchmaking or clockmaking. And I looked at these watches in this store, and they're absolutely beautiful. They're like probably the most beautiful watches I've ever seen. And I look at them and my eyes like get really big at the price tag of these things. Like $1,500 is like the bottom end. And they go up to like several thousand more dollars. And I'm looking at this and I'm like thinking, wow, that would be like, that'd be like an heirloom, like to buy a watch that nice and you pass it on to your kid and your grandkid and their kid and so on. And I start like creating this way of thinking about like, how could I get one of these watches? Now I've jumped on the people mover of consumerism and materialism and consumption, and I got to get this. And I think about how Mark Zuckerberg recently in a video was wearing a $900,000 watch, like almost $1 million watch. I'm like, at least I'm not a billionaire buying a watch that's almost $1 million. I mean, that's just ridiculous. But if I think about these questions that John Wesley asks, and, you know, you can get a really nice watch for like $100. Remember, ownership is an illusion. All right, first practice of gratitude, say a prayer of gratitude for each thing you buy. Second one, turn this into not just like an individual thing, but a communal practice. And I, you know, if you live in a family on a regular basis, whether it's like at dinner or whether it's at bedtime, reflect back on what you're grateful for the day. Like, create in you this posture of gratitude and abundance throughout the day. Now, if you are living by yourself, I mean, this might be a practice that you do with text messaging a friend or with a journal or at a small group that you participate in. But you always start with like, what is there to be grateful for today? I have for many years been in the practice of writing three things each day I'm grateful for. I've been a little lax on that lately, sort of shifting up some of my spiritual practices. But one thing that has maintained is at dinner time or bedtime, or any kind of prayer time, is like, what made you happy today? This is like what we do in Kids Creek and Teen Fuel. What's something to be grateful for? You always start with celebration, with gratitude. And then you can turn to, hey God, I could use some help. All right, turn to your neighbor and answer this question. How could you practice gratitude in one of these ways or others this week? Pray a prayer of gratitude at each purchase, or pray a dinner time family gratitude prayer. Let's talk about it. Life moves fast. A lot of times there's no exits, no off ramps. And so you gotta catch your breath when you can. You gotta find a quiet chair in your home or at work at lunchtime or in your bed before you fall asleep at night. And listen to this reflection from Ann Voskamp. No amount of regret changes the past. No amount of anxiety changes the future. But any amount of gratitude
changes the present.
All right, we're going to slow it really down here. And get comfortable. Find a way that you can relax a little bit. Lean back in your chair. Maybe put your hands up in your lap. And take a couple big deep breaths. And think back over your day. Look for those places to be grateful for. Look for those moments of gratitude and just name one or two to God right now. Take a moment and reflect over your most recent purchases. Where was there a missed place ownership for you? And if God's Spirit brings something up in your heart or your mind, well then confess that to God. And then ask God to give your heart, like to open your heart up and your eyes to see, to have a posture of gratitude. And out of that gratitude to flow a kind of generosity. Ask God for that sort of transformation and whatever words work for you. No amount of regret changes the past. No amount of anxiety changes the future. But any amount of gratitude changes the present. And all who agreed said, Amen.